frowned. I can't tell you. It's not exactly like I'll be repeating it to anyone, you know? Malcolm sighed. Don't confuse can't with won't. That question can't be answered in any way meaningful to you. Maybe not to anyone. Not yet. Perhaps one day there will be someone capable of understanding the answer. Perhaps one day there will be someone who doesn't need to ask. So you don't know everything. Again, the smile. Yes, and no. Wraith smirked. Seriously? Malcolm looked square at him. I'm being honest here, and you have no idea how rare this is. He smiled. It's not my fault you can't understand what I'm telling you. I'm about to die. Be nice. Malcolm nodded. Sorry. I suppose I could explain a little better. Malcolm picked up a pebble from the floor. If I let this drop, I know it will fall. I also know it will fall right about here. He pointed to the spot just below his hand. We both know that, right? We both know this absolutely. But he let go of the pebble, and before it hit the ground, he brought his foot over and knocked the stone aside. Things can change from moment to moment. Most of the time I'm right, but on occasion someone's foot gets in the way. Does that make any sense? How is that different from what anyone does? We all have expectations that don't always... I don't have expectations. I know. I know everything that will happen. Unless it is altered. I realize this seems like a fine line of difference. But it isn't. You mean you're like Magda, the Oracle? In a way. But while I would say I know a good deal more than any tree, I'm far less wise. Wraith made a point of looking him over. I'm guessing you aren't human. Are you Frey? Is that why you didn't know our customs? I once told you the Frey, the Durg, and the runes were all related. They are. The differences came later. The Frey had it the easiest and lived longer as a result. The Durg found solace in caves and were stunted, and in more ways than they're willing to admit. Humans had it the worst of all. I've been late getting to them. You're going to change all that. I'm sorry about this, about how things turned out. If it were possible. He sighed. Never mind. Can you tell me one thing? Not about Persephone, is it? He shook his head. About my sister and my mother. Oh. Malcolm nodded. You want to know if you'll see them again? I think about it. I think about it a lot. I never got to say goodbye. I never got to express my thanks. I don't know how the afterlife works. Don't know if I'll go to Elysian, Rel, or Nifril. And I don't know where my mother and sister are. Malcolm thought a moment. They gave their lives to save you. You're giving your life to save everyone else. I suspect the afterlife will look kindly upon all of that. You don't know? Or you can't tell me? He smiled. You're going to find out for yourself very soon. But I don't believe you have anything to worry about. Can you at least tell me your real name? It's not Malcolm, is it? It is now. I have been Malcolm for a few hundred years. A few hundred. Names are temporary things, like clothes. They serve to make us look a certain way, but are quite trivial and can be changed. It's like you're asking me what my real shirt is. What was your first shirt, then? That was a very long time ago, Malcolm said. But Wraith wasn't satisfied and stared until Malcolm sighed. Turin, he finally said. Turin was the name of a very young, very innocent, very stupid person. Wraith looked across at the forge where Roan drew out the glowing metal to begin the hammering. And you're certain this is the only way to make the world right, Turin? Unless someone's foot gets in the way. Speaking of feet. He stood up. I need to have a talk with Nephron, and make sure he keeps his on the ground, and doesn't do anything rash. I'm guessing that's a full-time job. It is with most people. Malcolm took two steps, then paused, and looking back added, including myself. Nephron was alone on the third-floor balcony that ran around the outside of the Verenthian when Malcolm found him. So much for your plans, he told his ex-slave. I think your prediction of me becoming the ruler of the world was a bit off. Try not to think too much. You don't have the talent for it. Nephron's brows rose. He was having trouble adjusting to this new Malcolm, this one-time slave who behaved as an equal. No, he thought, he acts like my superior, like my father. Nephron had never cared for the easy authority Zephyron exercised over him, one of the many reasons he'd spent so much time abroad with the Galentians. And he cared even less for Malcolm. If either of them had more than a day in their futures, he might have voiced his objection, settled the issue, but as it was, he couldn't see the point. They're creating bridges right now. He pointed down at the seven tongues, each of slightly different lengths, reaching out toward their side of the burn. Come morning. Not morning, Malcolm said. They'll attack tonight. He looked up at the stars. 2, maybe 3 hours. Nephron felt a surge of panic. Then it subsided. What difference does a few hours make? The result will be the same. Just as well, I suppose. No sense prolonging it. Malcolm stared at him, perplexed. You really think you're going to die? The Fane won't pardon me after this. No, I mean, you're certain the Fane will defeat us. Nephron looked out at the campfires, and then down at the rubble below them. We lost almost half our fighting force today, and that was without the Fane bringing in his infantry. Yes, we will all die. Maybe not you. Can you die? Malcolm smiled at him. What would it be worth to win this battle? There was no point in replying, so Nephron simply waited. He had no idea who or what Malcolm was. A Mirrolith, perhaps. But he'd never seen Malcolm perform magic. A Crimble Lord? There were legends about them, sometimes leaving Nog and visiting Alan. They possessed great powers, and weren't bound by the same laws as Runes, Frey, and Durg. But again, there was a lack of magic, and Crimbles were known to wallow in the stuff. He might be a demon, or spirit. Stories spoke of such things walking the face of Alan, and causing mischief to mortals. Whatever Malcolm was, Nephron certainly didn't like that smile. "You'll owe me a favor," Malcolm said. "I will ask you to do something, and you must do it. no matter what it is. Scary promise. It is. I won't kill myself. No, it won't be that. And I will be ruler of the entire civilized world. Malcolm paused in thought. Well, minus Belgrig. The Belgric Lungrins are about to have a bit of a revival. But you'll be allies. Fine, Mefren said. I did say civilized world. He stared at the thin figure before him, who didn't have a trustworthy face, and certainly wasn't a man. Why do I feel like you'll twist this into something terrible? You're right to be wary. I can tell you now that you won't like what I'll ask of you. Certainly not at the time I ask it. Wouldn't be much point in my making this agreement if it was something you'd agree to willingly. But it won't be anything too horrible, and in time you'll agree that I was right. They stood looking out at the torch and star-filled night, watching the growing bridges, seven fingers of death. So, do we have an agreement? If, by some miracle, we do win tomorrow, or tonight, how can I know it was you who made it happen? If you agree to my demand, then tonight you'll see a dragon rise from the rubble of Alonrist. This... He paused, and allowed a little smile to creep onto his lips. Gelarbrin will fend off the worst of the Fane's assault. The worst? And what of the rest? Malcolm pointed to the eastern sky. The Gula runes. Nefren shook his head. That's impossible. The fires were never lit. Malcolm's eyebrows rose sharply. Seriously? I just told you a dragon would rise up out of the rubble and do battle for you, but it's the coming of the Gula hordes that you can't believe? Okay. None of it is believable. So when it happens, when you see it all with your own eyes, and exactly as I've described, you'll know it was my doing, and you'll be bound to this agreement we make tonight. Yes? Nefren didn't need to think long. The bridges were growing at an uncomfortable speed. Malcolm was right about that much. The attack wouldn't be in the morning. Agreed. I just wish you were telling the truth. Padera and Malcolm were the first to enter Persephone's room after Nefren left.
That Frey downstairs is a terrible patient, Padera grumbled.
Sebek?
Is that his name? Terrible. Just terrible. Won't stay put. Won't listen.
She pointed at Malcolm.
Even when he translates, it does no good. That Sebek gets himself bleeding. Stubborn fool.
She smiled at Persephone, waddling over duck-like.
So, how are we doing?
I'm fine, but I need you to do a few things for me. Padera glared with one eye.
I am. I'm checking your bandages, she said, tugging at the covers. Wait. Who are you talking to?
Persephone held the blanket tight. Both of you. Malcolm, do you know about the pigeon loft?
He nodded.
I want you to send a message. She paused, trying to remember what Arion had told her months ago, when she stood in the carol and pleaded for her to send word. Arion had a very odd way of saying it. Something about the limitations of the system they used to convey reports. The symbols used were few and specific. There was no symbol for beautiful, bumblebee, happiness, or eagle, just to name a few. The script revolved only around the needed ideas for military reports and orders. Numbers, supplies, deaths, births, seasons, and such. and all of it was in a shortened form, so a message could be tied to, and carried by, a small bird. I can't remember how Arion put it, but you need to convey that runes are not animals. We are capable of the art. All we want is peace. Are you willing to find a way to end this war? That had been Arion's message. I'm only now seeing the wisdom in it. The Fane won't see the message in time, but maybe after he returns home, he will. Once he has regained his fortresses, and we no longer a threat, perhaps then he will read it. I hope he does, and it softens his heart so he won't kill all that remains of our people.
I actually have some experience with the messenger pigeons, Malcolm explained. I can handle it myself.
Good. That's better. I was worried about trusting the Instaria to write it correctly. This is important, Malcolm. Thank you. You've always been there for me, haven't you?
As I will always be, until the very end.
Persephone smiled. Sometimes he said the oddest things. No, it's not what he says. It's how he says it, as if he knows something I don't.
Let me see those stitches, Padera said.
No, I need you to find Wraith. Tell him I want to see him right away.
Of course, why not? The old woman threw up her hands. There's only a war on, and the place is an obstacle course of broken rubble. Why don't I rebuild the fortress while I'm at it?
Padera and Malcolm laughed, and Persephone laid her head back down on the pillow. She had done all she could to save her people. That part of her life was over. Only one loose end remained between her and a peaceful death. She needed to make a confession to a man she had lied to. Chapter 28 Wolves at the Door. I can honestly say, I was never more frightened in my life. It was not that I thought I might die. I knew I would. I knew it with the same certainty that I knew I was in love. All this, and I was only 16. The Book of Bryn.
Horns blew some time past midnight.
Tesh had finally gotten used to the bell announcing attacks, but the bell had fallen along with everything else. Trumpets were the new heralds of doom, and they woke him from a nightmare-filled slumber where Bryn was dying, trapped in the Kype. He couldn't reach her. No matter how many Frey he killed, more always came. He hadn't planned to sleep. Didn't even think it would be possible. He promised himself he'd just close his eyes for a moment. But after 16 hours of moving rocks to help build a makeshift wall, his body had betrayed him. Now Tesh ran across what remained of the courtyard. Jumping onto the collapsed remains of the old frozen tower, he looked down and saw 7 bridges that hadn't been there when he had gone to sleep. Across them, 7 columns of soldiers flowed above the chasm. All around, men ran wildly, trying to find each other, trying to locate their leaders, trying to understand what to do.
"Has anyone seen Wraith?" Tess shouted.
No one answered. No one knew. No one cared. Everyone had problems of their own.
He could join up with the men forming in the lower courtyard. He saw them from his perch, ragged lines coming together slowly. Both Harkon and Tegan were down there shouting. Wraith couldn't stop him from fighting this time. This time no one had a choice.
Tesh looked back over his shoulder toward the dome and the Kype. The nightmare was fresh enough that he had to resist an urge to look for Bryn.
My duty is to Wraith.
Wraith! Wraith!
He called, standing on the tips of his toes to see better.
There you are!
Tesh heard a woman yell at him as she hauled a bucket of water. Her name was Tressa. All he knew about her was that most people spat on the ground after she walked by.
"Wraith is in the smithy. He's been wanting to talk to you."
"Is that where you're going?" Tesh asked. The woman nodded. "Let me help you with that, then."
Tressa looked at him in shock as he took the bucket from her hands. The courtyard was an obstacle course of fallen rocks and rushing people, and he dodged his way across to the smithy. The furnace was going. He could see the firelight leaking out from under the door. Inside, he found Roan and the dwarfs working at the polishing table, while Suri and Wraith sat in opposite corners of the room, and Malcolm stood near the door.
"They're attacking," he announced. Heads came up, but no one moved.
"Wraith,"
Tesh said.
"I know,"
Wraith replied.
"They're forming up on the lower court. What do you want me to do?"
Wraith stood up and walked over. His movements, agonizingly slow, made Tesh want to scream. This was an emergency.
Seconds counted, and his chieftain was meandering his way through the stacks of charcoal and iron.
"We need to talk," Wraith told him.
"What? Now? The wrist is under attack. They've got bridges. They're coming over right now. 7 columns."
"Yeah, I know."
"You know?"
Tesh couldn't see how Wraith could possibly know if he'd been sitting in the smithy.
"This won't take long."
"What won't?"
Wraith lifted his good arm and put a hand on Tesh's shoulder.
"I want you to know that I'm proud of you, and that you're the closest thing I've had to a son. That if I had one, I would have wanted him to be like you."
"You think we're going to lose this fight?"
Tesh saw the defeat in Wraith's eyes. He'd already given up.
"No."
Wraith shook his head. "We're going to win. I even think that now we might win the war."
Tesh scrunched his face up. "You said this was a lost cause."
"Changed my mind."
"Odd time for that."
Someone outside shouted for more arrows to be brought to the Verenthian. Tesh looked out at the action of soldiers running, and hoped Wraith would hurry up.
"The victory will come at a price."
Outside, the trumpets blew again, and Tesh imagined that the fray were fighting in the lower courtyard.
"We can have this talk later, can't we?"
"No, we can't."
"Tesh, when... if anything happens to me, you'll be the last Dorian. You should make sure that our people don't die with you. You like Bryn, don't you?"
"I really don't think now is the time. Look, I need to get down to the..."
"Now is the perfect time, because I don't want you anywhere near the fighting."
"What? You can't be serious. You stopped me last time, and I can help."
"You can help more by living through this night."
"What do you want me to do? Cower somewhere?"
Tesh exploded.
"You're being stupid. I can..."
"I want you to go to the Kaip and protect Bryn."
Tesh remembered his dream and lost some of his anger. "And when this battle is over," Wraith said, "I want you to start a family. Raise children and live a good and happy life. Someplace safe and green, like on a high bank overlooking the Urdam River. I want you to do what I never could."
"Why is he telling me all this now?"
Tesh noticed the others watching them, Suri and Malcolm especially. The tattooed girl had tears glistening on her cheeks.
"Why are you..."
"You have talents, and you've learned to use them. But don't let that be your whole life. Dorians have always been known as warriors, but you need to change that. Promise me you'll do something good, that you'll make your life worth something more than killing."
"What's this about?"
"Promise me."
"But I don't understand why."
"Promise me,"
Tesh looked at Wraith. His eyes were desperate. He thinks he's going to die tonight. Maybe the mystic had foretold his death. Tesh heard she had magic powers, and Wraith's eerie calm unnerved him. Okay, I promise. Wraith smiled. Good. Now go to Bryn. Take care of her. Be a good man, and a good father. Tesh, who had been eager to leave a moment before, lingered a moment longer. He was missing something. There was tension in the smithy, a strange silence. What's going on? You'll find out, Wraith said. For now, your chieftain has given you an order. Get going. Tesh stared at him, trying to understand. But it was impossible, and memories of his nightmares pushed him out the door. Bryn couldn't find Tesh. Minutes felt like hours, and hours turned into an eternity. With each passing second, her desperation grew. When the horn started blowing, she knew her time was up. With that sound, every man stopped what he was doing and rushed down toward the lower courtyard, forming up. That's where he'll go, she realized. He wants to be at the front of the line. The lower courtyard was no place for a keeper of ways, but she desperately needed to see Tesh one last time.
Bryn! Chieftain Harkin shouted. Get out of here, lass! The enemy is upon us! Run back to the Kype! Do it now!
Bryn ignored sense and joined the ranks of men rushing down the steps. She was shocked by the devastation of everything below the upper courtyard. Collapsed buildings and towers had blocked access to the city streets, but the stairs and a pathway had been cleared all the way down to the lower courtyard. Walking down to where the front gates had been felt like swimming out too far. She was going too deep, getting over her head. When she reached the bottom, where men were forming in lines, replacing the stone wall with one of flesh and blood, she still didn't see Tesh. The sound of marching made her look east. The seven bridges were complete, and the elven army was crossing. With no place left to look for Tesh, she headed back, but each step she took hurt. She just wanted to see him one last time, wanted to say goodbye, share a final kiss. She didn't think that was too much to ask. She didn't think it would be so hard. As she ran back to the upper courtyard, she felt her heart breaking. Her desire to say goodbye had become a genuine need. She had to see him once more before the end of the world. It's not fair. Others had years. Padera had been blessed with decades. What did she and Tesh have? Not much. Just a few days to love, to fight, to hold and to cry. Bryn wanted nothing more than to grow old with him, to live the life her mother had. She wanted to spend day after boring day in a tiny home and suffer endless nights listening to him snore. When he was sick, she would have brought him soup. On his birthday, she would have surprised him with a new pair of mittens she'd spent months knitting. Bryn wanted to be cooped up through long winters beside him, the two curled up like a pair of chipmunks in a den. She wanted to give him children, watch them grow up, see them marry and have their own children. How would Tesh look with grey hair? How would it be to sip tea in front of their own home, watching grandchildren play? She would never know. I got one kiss. One lousy kiss. Bryn! She whirled and saw Tesh running at her. Bryn flung her arms out and pulled him to her. Squeezing as hard as she could, she kissed him. Then she did it again and again, her lips still against his, her hands making fists in his hair and shirt. She said, "I wanted to say goodbye."
"Goodbye?"
She let her cheek slide next to his and spoke in his ear. "You're going to fight with the rest, and by morning we'll all be dead. I had to see you. I had to say goodbye. I had to. I have to tell you. I love you." She hadn't planned on saying it. Bryn hadn't even thought it before. The words just came out, but the moment they left her lips, she knew it was true. That was the real reason she'd been so desperate to find him. "I love you too," he said.
"He loves me."
She kissed him again. Horns were blaring. She heard shouts and the clang of metal. She ignored it all. The world could fall apart. She no longer cared.
"Bryn, what the tet are you doing here?"
Moya ran at them, along with an onrush of swordsmen and archers. Her face was fierce, her bow strung.
"The lower yard is overrun. They're coming up the steps. Get to the Kaip. Move!"
Padera was just making her way down when the whole world started coming up. She was on her way to find Wraith, and the best place to start looking was the barracks. That was across the Corbel Bridge, through the Varenthian, and down the long, narrow stairs to the upper courtyard. She only got as far as the bridge.
"Don't go out there," Grigor said.
The giant stood guard beside the bronze door, which, for the time being, was left open, so he could look out.
"Persephone wants me to get a message to Wraith."
Grigor shook his head.
"Too late for that. The Fane's army is across the ford."
The old woman stood with the giant in the doorway of the Kaip, looking out at the end of the world. The sky was swirling again. Dark, unnatural clouds covered the stars, folding and unfolding, making threatening faces at the living. Lightning flashed between the shades of grey, brilliant bolts of white that cracked and boomed.
"I wish it would rain," Grigor said.
Padera glanced at him. No matter how she tilted her head, or how tightly she squinted her one eye, she could never manage to fill her expression with enough incredulity.
"Did you say you wished it would rain?"
"Yes."
"Why in the world—"
"Because it'd only be a storm then, wouldn't it? Just a spring rain. We could shutter the windows and bolt the doors, and it would blow over as all downpours do. But this isn't one of those storms, is it?"
From beyond the dome, she saw streaks of red light coming from the far side of the ford. One struck the remaining forward tower and sheared off the top.
"No," she said. "No, it's not."
Screams were carried on the wind. Cries of pain and horror rose up from the village and the lower yards, faint enough to be the wails of ghosts.
"My relatives have arrived."
Grigor pointed down at the seven bridges, as huge Grenmorians lumbered across, wielding great clubs that they used to bash chunks out of anything still standing.
"Why aren't you with them?"
"Don't get along with my family."
He looked down at her.
"No one gets along with their family,"
Padera replied.
"They tried to kill me. Twice. Sheer luck saved me the first time. Second time it was Nifrin. Didn't look back after that."
The world shook, and both Grigor and Padera staggered, reaching for the doorframe for support.
"They're doing that again," she said. treating this fortress like a dog treats a rabbit caught in its teeth.
Another shake, and the dome of the Verinthian cracked like an egg. Just a tiny spidery line, but the fissure, jagged and terrible, declared a prophecy. A moment later, a horde of people spilled out from under the dome. A sprinting line of evacuees raced across the Corbel Bridge toward Grigor and Pedera. Most were soldiers, including the chieftains Tegan and Harkon, but leading the pack were Moya, Bryn, Tekchin, and Tesh. The prophecy fulfilled itself as the dome fell. Dust of broken stone belched from the belly of the Verinthian, a cloud that obscured the length of the span. Pedera lost sight of everyone for a long, awful moment. Then Moya appeared, slick with sweat, pumping her arms, her bow held high in one hand. Grigor and Pedera moved clear, as dust-covered soldiers poured in.
"Seal the door!" Tegan shouted when the last survivor dove inside.
Grigor looked more than pleased to slam the bronze door shut and lay the metal brace.
"Everything on the other side of that door is lost to us."
Harkon wiped the dust and grime from his face.
"They crushed us at the front gate." Bergen panted for air. "There's no stopping them."
Tegan placed a hand against the closed door, as if willing it to hold.
"There's too many."
"Then the light show started," Harkon grumbled.
"And now they have giants," Moya said, glancing at Grigor.
"I'm going up to Persephone. I'll die with her."
The others didn't say anything, but many nodded.
"I'll stay here and hold this door," Tegan declared. "I hate stairs."
"Me too."
Harkon pulled his sword and weighed it in his hands.
"Stairs are the gods' curse to men."
"I'm going to stay," Tesh told Bryn,
who took a step back as if she'd been pushed.
"It's the best way to protect you."
"Why are you down here?" Moya asked Pedera. "I was sent to find Wraith."
Moya shook her head and pointed at the door with her bow.
"There's nothing on the other side of that door now except bodies."
In the smithy, heads jerked at the sound of another explosion, but Malcolm seemed unconcerned. Tressa and the dwarfs stared wide-eyed at the door as screams came from directly outside. Wraith knew those sounds would come back to them in nightmares for the rest of their lives, if they survived the night. There were other sounds, too. Deep booms, clangs, and the howl of whirlwinds. Something banged against the little wood door. 8 vertical maple boards held together by a Z-brace with a simple brass latch. Roan worked a foot pedal similar to a spinning wheel, but this one rotated an arm of soft cloth. Then she stopped and, pulling a rag from the waist of her leather apron, wiped the sword in her hands. Turning, she held the weapon to the light of the forge and nodded to herself. Then, still chasing down smudges with the rag, she carried the blade across the room and handed it to Wraith, holding it out with both hands and using the cloth so that no part of her skin left a print.
"I did my best," Roan said.
Long, shimmering, and with a rich black color, the sword was perfection. Roan's skill at a forge and anvil had grown beyond imagining. The object she placed in his hands wasn't a sword, wasn't a weapon at all. It was a work of art. Everyone in the room stared at him as he looked at it. "This isn't a sword for me to wield. I'm looking at... I'm holding... my own death."
"I..."
Roan's voice cracked, then just stopped. She bit her lip and started to cry.
"It's beautiful," Wraith told her. "The most amazing thing I've ever seen. Thank you."
She began to sob, to collapse. She ran back to the work table but pushed the stool aside and sat on the floor, drawing her knees up. That's when Wraith realized the obvious. The sword had been her support, and not just the one he held. All the swords, the shields and armor that Roan had made were the pillars she had lashed herself to in order to remain standing. The work had been her distraction, her world within the world, her retreat. But this blade was the last, and the war was finally knocking. Wraith weighed the sword in his hands, heavy, well-balanced, and magnificent. He turned it, and the glow of the forge shone across his face. More screams came from beyond the door. He heard a man cry, "Help me! Help me!"
"Promise me, Wraith."
He recalled his mother's voice, shaking with the cold and coming out in puffs of frost.
"Promise me you'll do something good, that you'll make your life worth something."
He walked across the room to Suri. She was sitting on the floor in the same cross-legged manner she had in Dal Ren, only now her hair and skin were clean, and she wore a lavish ersica after the fashion of the ranking Frey. She looked up at him as he held out the sword.
"I guess this means I'll never learn to juggle."
He meant it as a joke, something to break the tension. Suri started crying.
"Sorry,"
he said, and sighed. "So, how does this work? Will I remember who I am? Who I was? Will I have memories?"
"I don't know," Suri said, sniffling. "Mina..."
She shook her head.
"It really wasn't Mina at all. And yet I felt that part of Mina was there."
"And this sword?" He looked at it again.
"This will be used to destroy me after I get done fighting the Frey." "You'll be destroyed in the making. I honestly don't know how much of you may linger in the beast. Maybe none. It might just have been what I put into the conjuration that made it seem like Mina. The sword will break the weave. If any part of you is trapped, it will be set free by the sword."
"So, what do I do now?" She reached out and took the blade.
"Just lie down," she told him.
He did, and she placed the fabulous sword on his chest.
"Doesn't it need my name on it?"
"Yes. But that..."
Suri squeezed her lips together, turning the pink to white, and her eyes tightened, squinting as if in agony. She took a deliberate breath.
"When Mina died, I didn't have a sword or anything, so her name was imprinted on my mind by her escaping spirit. When your spirit leaves your body, it will pass through the sword and leave your name there. It will be you who writes it, using the language of creation."
Wraith nodded. Something hit the door to the smithy again, something hard. The hinges rattled.
"We're running out of time! They're going to break in!"
Flood burst out, his voice an octave higher than usual.
"No,"
Suri said calmly, softly. "That door won't open until I allow it." She looked at Wraith.
"And when it does, they'll wish it hadn't."
Suri ran her hands along the blade. Such a beautiful thing to be created for such an awful purpose. She shuddered and brought a hand to her face. I don't know who this is going to hurt more, Wraith said. Me or you? Suri lifted her head to look at him, tears running down her face. Me, Suri told him, without a hint of humor. You won't feel a thing, but I will. A tear fell from her chin and splashed onto the shimmering blade. I'll feel it every day, every single day. For the rest of my life, I'll see your eyes as they are right now. The same way I still see Mina's. She had blue eyes. Bright blue eyes. So very, very bright. Just so you know, I'm not leaving anything behind, Wraith told her. In many ways, you're doing me a favor. If that makes this any easier. Suri placed her hand upon the black, shimmering blade. It doesn't. Persephone sat up in her bed. Propped by a pillow against the carved headboard, she listened to the sounds of battle. Explosions rumbled the stone so hard that the canopy above the bed quivered. In Persephone's right hand, she held the little sword Rhone had made. In her left, she squeezed the blanket. She held both so tightly, her hands ached. She was scared. It will be over soon. Everything will be over. At any minute, a fray would break in the chamber door. Someone not unlike Nephron. Her mind told her that. Her emotions imagined monsters, fangs, glowing eyes, claws, something similar to the Rao, only bigger, much bigger. Shouts, cries, the thunder of feet, then it finally happened. The door to the outer room of her suite burst in. Persephone flinched, almost screamed. "They've crossed the Corbel Bridge," Moya said, panting as she entered. Her face and arms were shiny from sweat, the longbow held in her left hand, the sack of arrows slung over her right shoulder. Brynn and Pedera followed her. The old woman shambled through the archway and around the end posts with her famous frown and squinty eyes. In contrast, Brynn was terrified. She raced in, cheeks streaked with tears. "Up on the bed!" Persephone shouted, waving for them. Brynn leapt up and hugged her tight. The girl was shaking. Pedera sat herself on the other side of the bed, and, taking off one of her sandals, she rubbed her foot. Moya stood in front of the door, her bow out, an arrow fitted to the string, four more in her draw hand, in between her fingers, five bunched in her left, along with a bow shaft. "What's going on?" Persephone asked them. "The bridges are finished, and the elven army has crossed the ford," Brynn explained. "They came with hardly a warning," Moya said. "Hundreds pouring over the chasm, both beautiful and terrible, wearing shining gold and shimmering blue. With them came whirlwinds and giants. Nothing can stop them. They're coming still." Boom. "They're here," Moya said, looking out through the archway into the sitting room, as if she could see them. "That would be them hitting the bronze door downstairs. Tegan and Harkon are trying to hold it with a handful of men." She looked at Persephone. "Gavin Killian and Bergen are with them." Persephone didn't know why Moya told her about Gavin and Bergen. Maybe she felt it would be comforting to know that men of Dol Ren were defending her. At the sound of their names, Persephone remembered her home of long ago and far away, a world of another time that was only a year lost. She saw the stone table and Mara between the braziers at the foot of the lodge steps. She recalled the summer fairs, where Bergen served honey mead, barley ale, and strawberry wine, and the dark winter nights, when Gavin told his ghostly tales around the lodge's fire, scaring Habit into adding more wood than was needed. That whole existence was gone. Even its memories were being hunted down and erased. "I came to tell the chieftain we're going to die." Suri's voice came back to her, eerily innocent, spoken in that detached-from-reality manner that had so confounded Persephone. "Who's going to die?"
"All of us."
"All of whom? You and I?"
"Yes. You, me,
the funny man with the horn at the gate.
Everyone."
Persephone had thought the girl was merely looking for food. She also believed Suri was lying. Persephone had been wrong. The only thing Suri had lied about was the possibility of hope, that heeding the counsel of the trees could help. Persephone had done everything Magda had said, but none of it had saved them. Suri had been right. "We're all going to die. You, me, the old woman, the young girl, the people outside, everyone." Wraith had been right. They couldn't win. But he had been wrong, too. Even knowing how it turned out, Persephone would have still chosen to stay.
"Death is inescapable. Everyone spends their days buying unrealized dreams. I gambled mine on hope, not for myself, but for all those who would follow."
The kite rocked as something powerful impacted its base. Dust fell from rafters, and out in the sitting room, a golden cup fell from its seat on the stone moulding and rang on the floor.
"I'm so scared."
Rin hugged Persephone tightly, pressing her head against Persephone's side.
"Will it hurt terribly, do you think?"
"No, child," Hedera answered for her. "The Frey are not ones for sport."
"She's right," Persephone assured, although she had no idea if it was true. And she knew Pedera didn't either.
"It will be quick, and we'll all be together again. Your mother and father, Man, Reglan..."
"Melvin and my boys," Pedera added. "Been too long since I've seen them, anyhow."
"Maeve,"
Bryn said hopefully. Persephone nodded and brushed the hair from the girl's eyes.
"Cobb, Farmer Whedon, Holliman, the Killians."
Moya listed them, as if making sure to invite everyone to the after-party.
"And Arya?"
Persephone glanced at Pedera, who managed to find a smile in those lips, after all.
"And Wraith," Persephone thought. "Would they really all be there?"
The door of the suite opened, and Moya's bow stretched.
"Nefrin!" Bryn shouted, warning her off.
The leader of the Galantians entered with a half-dozen men, as well as Vorath, Ares, Grigor, and Tekchin.
"Brace the door!"
Persephone heard Nefrin shout. Tegan and Tekchin carried Harkon into the bedroom. The Melon clan chieftain was bleeding from several wounds, the most obvious being a gash in his skull that ran a stream of red into the man's eyes. All of them were covered in blood, even Tekchin.
"Did you..."
Moya asked him. He threw an arm around Moya's neck, pulled her to him, and gave her a long kiss.
"No," the Frey said, with a pronounced tone of disappointment that bordered on self-disgust. "They certainly helped."
Tegan jumped to the Galantian's defense as he used his sword to cut into the foot of Persephone's bedsheet.
"Pardon, Madam Koenig."
"Take the whole thing if you need it."
Persephone's heart was pounding. Seeing the blood made the nightmare real.
"We have bandages on that table," Pedera pointed out. "Needle and thread, too.
Tegan looked over.
"Give me that thing!" Harkin yelled, and stole the cloth from Tegan's hands and began to wipe his face.
"You can worry about seeing later," Tegan growled, and took the cloth back, pressing it against the wound. "Need to dam this bloody river you have flowing."
At the bedroom door, Grigor peeked in.
"You made it,"
Pedera said. The giant grinned at her.
"What happened to Tesh?"
Rin left Persephone's side and, taking bandages from the table, handed them to Tegan.
"Don't know," Tegan replied. "He was with us, but when the door was breached, we all ran. I was too busy worrying about myself to pay attention to where everyone went."
"The fray saved us," Harkin said, while helping to hold the new wad of cloth to his own head, as Tegan and Bryn worked to tie a bandage around it. "Threw themselves in the way, blocked their attacks, gave us time to—"
"Here they come," Ares shouted from the sitting area.
Tekchin leapt out of the bedroom to join him, and Moya raced to the archway, stationing herself between the two rooms, Grigor to her left. Persephone heard a thud, then a bang, and finally the sound of wood splintering as the door to the hallway broke open. Moya let her first arrow fly, and had another knocked immediately. Shouts and cries filled the sitting room.
"Get me up! Get me up!" Harkin ordered.
Tegan lifted the chieftain and put his sword back in his hand.
"Can't see!" Harkin wavered. "Blood's in my eyes!"
"Relax! I'll tell you when to swing," Tegan said.
Looking past her shield, Persephone saw the fray force their way into the sitting room. Just as Moya had described, they were both beautiful and terrible, wearing brilliant gold and shimmering blue. They killed Tanner Riggles in the blink of an eye. Three other men were cut down as the Fane's army forced its way in. Moya fired arrow after arrow. Many found their targets. Gold and blue uniforms littered the floor.
"Get the little spear-thrower!" someone shouted in fray. That's when Tekchin rushed them. Or tried to.
Grigor threw the fray aside and stepped in the way.
"You have an afterlife to go to. Grenmorians just turn to dust."
Grigor unleashed his massive sword, moving with surprising speed and not-so-surprising strength. The bronze armor prevented the fray from being cut in half, but his strokes must have shattered bones. Whomever he hit didn't get up. For a moment, Persephone thought there might be hope. If the Galantians could hold them, and Moya could shoot. But then the wall to the hallway exploded, and Frey poured into the sitting room. Grigor took a spear thrust to his shoulder and another to his side. He staggered. Vorath rushed to his aid and was the first to fall as three blades hit him from behind. Persephone didn't see it, but she heard Ares cry his name. Watching through the doorway that separated the bedroom from the sitting area, Persephone saw Grigor beaten back. The giant made a courageous charge into their ranks, disrupting the assault and clearing a swath, but more filled in the gaps. Valiant as he was, the flood was too great.
"Are we all that's left?" Persephone wondered. "Is everyone else in the fortress dead?"
Grigor flew backward, and Persephone saw a fray, dressed not in armor, but wearing an assacre, enter the sitting room.
"Myrilith!"
Moya saw him too, and fired her next shot at his chest. The arrow evaporated in mid-flight. The Myrilith fixed her with a terrible glare, and thrust out his hands.
"Moya!"
Persephone shouted as, like the giant, the shield to the Kinik was thrown off her feet. Tesh was surprised to find Sebek alone, the fray convalescing in the little room one floor down from the top of the kype had no guard watching his door. While it was Sebek's responsibility to protect Nephron, The Galantian leader apparently felt no need to reciprocate. Not that it would matter. None of them would live through the next few hours. Still,